Hello and welcome to this episode of The Politics of Living. I'm your host, Denise Kovalchuk. This program takes a look at the politics and all that we experience in life, whether it's telling your life story, learning about life from your daughter, or navigating heartbreak in response to gun violence. Politics are everywhere. On today's show, Darka Dusty shares her thoughts about gun violence and a song that helped her begin healing. Kristen Thiel introduces us to two women artists who made space for women where it hadn't existed before. Vicky Mazzone chats with one of the founders of an online site generating art to raise funds for social justice efforts. And a new segment, Storytelling with Lynn Fitch. But first, contributor Inessa Anderson recently spoke with Inara Vazemniks. She's an author of the book Among the Living and the Dead. The book was published this past summer. It's part memoir, part historical record, as it covers the fissures of Eastern Europe route in the wake of World War II. Inessa speaks with Inara about what it takes as a writer to weave reporting and myth to craft an account of love, loss, and survival.
It's the hardest thing for me. Generally, I avoid titling at all costs. It seems to be the one thing that I'm absolutely terrified about and will leave things untitled for as long as I possibly can. So it was a long time coming to arrive at that particular title for the book.
How do you write? You know, a lot of people write longhand. How do you do it?
I do it on the computer. I know a lot of friends, though, who find that longhand is almost a kind of meditation and it slows you down. But I love the fact that I can copy and paste and move things around, but I also do tend to be word by word, sentence by sentence, and there's something about even just having that kind of blank page that almost calms me mm-hmm. and helps me to focus and find each word one at a time.
Among the Living and the Dead, which was published this past summer, and it seems the perfect thing to delve into in our current, you know, geopolitical climate that's still putting out fires of war and battling communities and failing to take time to understand immigrant issues. Of course, I am an immigrant, and you come from immigrant people mm-hmm. from Latvia. And so I think this book will resonate. Don't you feel that?
I do. And I was actually really surprised because certainly I was simply focused on my family's story, trying to find a way to research that and express that. And it felt like I was so tightly zeroed in on that, that it took me a while to realize that there is actually a much greater resonance in the way that you can almost take what is happening right now and put it like a stencil over the top of that past World War II. It's eerie and unsettling and actually at times quite maddening to see how parallel things are still.
Those stories that you've collected and managed to pull out of your relatives and friends and different sources is the same story of many of the Latvians, many of the refugees that were fleeing into Western Europe. And so a lot of this book is about that, but it's also about self-discovery. So it's a memoir mm-hmm. of your family, but it's also self-discovery for you, Inara. So, but I want to begin with you, Inara, and a little bit of background on who you are, what have you been doing in life, what interests you, because you lived here in Portland for a time.
I worked for 13 years as a reporter with The Oregonian. And actually, for the longest time, I only ever dreamed of being a reporter, being a journalist. I think growing up in a refugee family where stories were a very critical currency, stories were the way by which everyone returned home, stories were the way that my grandmother was able to access the place she left behind and gifted it to me. I heard, you know, so often that lives and worlds could come alive through words. And I was especially interested in other people's stories. So someone must have given me the word for what that is. And they said reporter. And I said, okay, that's what I want to do. I pursued that pretty single-mindedly. But as I began to report, and the more I reported, and the more people I met, I began to see that I was kind of spilling out beyond the borders of what I would be allowed to do in a daily newspaper.
Yeah.
My sensibility is more hanging out with people, being able to just sit in their homes and talk to them and watch life unfold. I was always really interested in quiet stories, even when I was a reporter, stories that were the kind of stories that take place in a living room or in a kitchen, mm-hmm. Stories where sometimes it seems like even nothing is happening. And so as I began to think about what I wanted to do that might be beyond journalism, I started thinking that I wanted to go back to school. So I actually left the paper and
But went, you're not from Portland originally.
I'm from Tacoma, Washington, mm-hmm. originally. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And but the Northwest always felt right. like home. And right. really, my husband and I had a really solid foundation here. We had friends. We had a house. I sort of decided to kind of leap off the cliff without a safety net and went back to school and got my MFA. And
where did you go to school?
I went to the University of Iowa.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so you chose Iowa.
I chose Iowa. Yeah,
for,
Iowa.
For writing?
Because, for writing.
Because it's, it is known for, it's known as a writing
it's,
school.
It's heaven for mm-hmm. writers. It right. really is. I joke with people, you know, if you love celebrities, it's so much fun to go to LA. It's like Us Weekly. If you love The New Yorker, it's wonderful to go to Iowa City. You run into Marilyn Robinson in the co-op, you know.
And yeah,
it's,
yeah,
it's
yeah.
just a, it's an incredible place that way. And for me, it was such a wonderful experience being so immersed in the craft of writing with other people who were as equally passionate about it. And that's when I began to work on the book there. That's when I actually began.
How long ago was that?
I started in 2010.
Oh.
Yeah.
And here we are in 2017.
Exactly.
Sometimes people ask me, and I have not written my book yet, for the record. But people do ask, how do you get started on a book? You know, I mean, the idea, maybe, who knows? It sounds to me like that idea for your book, Among the Living and the Dead, has been in your heart and mind for quite a long time. Even before 2010,
although I never imagined, again, being so bent on journalism in a profession in which you write about other people, I didn't think I'd write about my family. I felt somehow that that was maybe, I don't know if I felt like it was too self-centered. I kept thinking it needed to be something outside of me, that that is where people's interest would lie. That was where the important stories were. And it was really my editor at the time at The Oregonian, even then, who said, you know, if you ever write a book someday, it should really be about your family. It should be about your grandmother. And I thought, no. It'll be something journalistic, and it won't be that. But it kept calling to me, and I realized, yes, indeed, I'd kind of been collecting what I needed over a lifetime in order to be able to try to approach this particular story. And part of that was having the kind of objective position that journalism gives you, so that I could circle around it, not just in a very intense emotional way, which was also required, but also to try to float above it and to see it from a kind of distance.
You do acknowledge many, many people who have been your guides along the way, your teachers and your inspirations and your relatives. How did you have to clear out your life to make this happen?
I made my life very, very small. And one of the things that I think a lot of people discover, writers, but also other artists, is that oftentimes in order to get your work done, you have to disappear. You have to completely, in some ways, disappoint all your friends, your loved ones, your lovers. You're not available, because you need to fully occupy and inhabit that creative space. It requires you to kind of shut everything else out.
Right, because I'm thinking that as a memoir, you have to do all the detailed detective work, thanks to a lot of people in your family.
Mm-hmm.
But as a thought piece, a very poetic one, that takes going someplace else. By yourself, more than likely. Yeah.
It was really helpful, I have to say, over the course of the book. We talked a little bit about how long it was in process, in essence. You know, essentially 2010 to 2015 in terms of research and writing it. And over the course of that time, I kept traveling to Latvia. I would be in Latvia as often as I could.
Is that when those trips began? Because not to give anything away, but a large part of that research then was where you went to your grandmother's sisters, where they grew up.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then you met all that crowd over there.
Yes, for the first time. I mm-hmm. went in 29 for the first time, and then began to go back summers, winter break, every time that I could. And it was really important for the research, of course, and the reconnection to family. But it also was very important because there was something about life in the countryside in particular that made my world very small in the way that was actually necessary for great creativity and to be able to find the words. It was a very simple, quiet existence.
There's a beautiful passage in your book that talks about they were in Riga, the capital city, and it was just filled with confusion and soldiers and fear, and they decided to go out to the country to seek, you know, the bored old horse, you know, and the cow and the, you know, all those small things that make life so simple and yet so excruciatingly important.
that was the lesson I felt when I was there, was I had a sort of shorthand for myself, TLT, the little things. The little things were so amplified, the taste of a berry, the sound that the horses make as they're eating their hay. The passage that you're recalling is my grandmother, my grandfather, and they had just had their first child. And the backdrop in Riga is one, as you said, of absolute chaos. The horror is building in terms of, you know, human cruelty to one another. The sort of Holocaust is building. And they end up taking a trip out to the countryside for what really seems to be, in retrospect, an opportunity to kind of reset and reclaim their humanity by focusing on the little things. One of my goals was not simply to work in the territory of memory. Certainly that was an important place to live inside, but I also wanted to make sure that I was venturing outside into what could be gathered from archives, from files in dusty buildings, which nobody got access to, diaries, oral histories, all those things seemed really important to me.
The source, you're talking about your sources.
Yeah.
That is actually, I would suggest to our listeners that that is a great reading list. That I don't know how many sources you have there. It looks like dozens and dozens and dozens.
Yeah, I went ahead and I even culled the sources. I listed those that I felt were like the most significant, in part because I hoped that people in some respects would trail me, would follow behind me and feel motivated to look at those resources themselves.
I do. It's in the very back of the book and you can just start at the top and we work your way down. You were raised by your grandparents. How did that come to be?
My parents had a really terrible coming undone. They were... my mother was extremely young when she met my father. My father was carrying a lot of the burdens of war. He had been just a few weeks old when his mother first fled the capital, fled Riga, and fled into the most bloody and awful part of World War II. She just headed straight into it with him in her arms.
She was just months old.
And then he had, he grew up in the displaced persons camps.
This is the story of many, many, many
Absolutely.
Of that era immigrants.
Absolutely.
Refugees.
And it had a tremendous effect on him. And he hadn't quite sorted all that out. There really wasn't a vocabulary. There, a lot of times trauma is beyond words. How do you find a way to express it? And then sort of on top of all that, then he ended up having to serve in Vietnam. So he was reeling from not only the ghosts of war, but then his own trauma from having to participate in war. And so they came apart, my mother and my father, and neither one was in a position really to be able to take care of me. And at that point, my grandmother stepped in and said, I will take her. And it was my lucky strike. Mm-hmm. In many ways, I was two at the time. She, I think, saw the opportunity as someone who had endured so much loss, so much sadness, so much violence. She saw in me an opportunity to kind of offer another generation some respite, some solace, some refuge from that. The inheritance of war is something that I feel is so critical for us to be thinking about and thinking about now as well. Again, it ripples out through generations that you see the way in which it influences choices far, far into the future and literally charts the courses of lives in so many intense directions.
Now that you've been on your book tour, your book has been published, you're getting those accolades, and you've created your book, you're talking with people on the road, any new takeaways that you kind of were unexpected, maybe?
I've been really amazed by, first, the response of other Latvians, the way in which people see both parts of their family story in this particular story, but then also the way that they have shared their own experiences. So I feel like in many ways, I wish I could keep adding to the book and keep adding to the collective
Part
stories
two.
That I'm hearing. Yeah, it's really incredible how in many ways it offers an opening for people to talk about what they experienced and the power of that and the power of those stories. The other thing, though, that I've been really amazed by is the interest among those who are not Latvian and the way that people are seeing that this little country and what it experienced in the war is almost a kind of inside-out way to understand World War II from a different perspective, and particularly the experience of those displaced by war.
So I wanted to fast forward into the present moment and talk a little bit about what you're doing now. You're teaching creative nonfiction at the University of Iowa. And what exactly is creative nonfiction?
Really, we can just say it is not writing about life, real experience, but attempting to do so in a way that is literary, where the form, where language, where your sort of structure, all of those things matter as much as the research that you're doing. Studying in that program, actually, where I now teach, turned out to be really important for me because it gave me the opportunity to create, in essence, my own kind of independent research in finding a form that would be more than perhaps what we might usually associate with simply a memory-based memoir, what might be more than a historical account. And so I was really kind of trying to work on something that felt like sort of a hybrid of a number of different forms and all told in a way that would emphasize a sense of story, that you were living inside a story, not just getting facts, not just getting a history, not just getting a recounting of what happened, but being swept along on an experience.
That's why I'm saying I think that this book was in you a long time ago in many, many different ways.
I was talking with a friend today who is a photographer, and he was recounting a project that he's working on right now, which is involving essentially almost like a collaboration between himself and refugees sharing with him items that they took with them when they fled. And so he will photograph the items, but then they write the story that goes along with the items. And he said, I feel like this is the culmination of every single thing I've done up to now that's bringing me to this point. And as he was saying that, I was thinking, yes, there's this incredible moment when you can clock that in your own life, when you can say, everything I've done, I can see all the strands of it coming together in this one thing. And I feel very fortunate that I can say that about this book. I feel like my training as a journalist, I feel like the big risks I took in terms of sort of leaving the life I knew and facing the unknown caused a kind of personal reflection that was so significant for this book. And then just the study that I was doing of literature and thinking about different approaches and different ways to engage with story all were able to come together in this one work.
What are you seeing in your students these days in this climate that's both political and creative, as there seems to be a sense that in my mind and world that creativity and art are the things that can set us free from the worries of what's unfolding? We've always had those crazy rides, you know, like a roller coaster. Our parents did. We've seen a lot of that, the Vietnam War, the big protests, you know, that were raging on, you know, people burning their draft cards. Creativity and art were the ways that I could set myself free from whatever worry, concern, you know, and love, of course, for other human beings, finding out who they are, that our voices need to be heard.
I'm seeing an incredible urgency. I'm seeing that they are intensely animated by the fact that they possess the skills to write about real things that are happening to real people. And I kind of keep saying over and over again, you are in such a critical place right now with your abilities, with the gifts that you have. You are here now to write, to witness, to get in there and make sure that these stories are being disseminated far and wide. And certainly in a creative form as well, because I think one of the things that art can do, art can allow us a kind of a backdoor way of having people engage in a conversation that might be impossible with simply politicized rhetoric. Art allows us to talk about many of the same issues which we must be confronting right now, but in a way that I think allows for perhaps a little bit more eye-to-eye, face-to-face kind of engagement. And so I see my students being both very aware that they are living in very, very critical times, and also aware of the fact that they have the tools to actually try to have an impact, to try to affect change.
Well, it's like your photographer friend who, you know, I'm thinking that maybe one of your students might see an immigrant family and somehow get to know them and sit in their living room, as you were describing, mm-hmm. those small stories that are so important, mm-hmm. small things that make up the bigger life. And I get chills thinking about what they might be able to accomplish, because the first thing I thought of at the end of last year was, we need art now more than ever. Absolutely. In all its forms.
Creativity, I think, is also, mm-hmm. I know that there's...
Creativity.
And there's a debate, though. I mean, that you know, in this sort of rise of alternative facts or, you know, fake news, that there might be a little bit of a fear about, you know, sort of how far creativity can be pushed, perhaps.
Do you talk about that in your class?
It comes. I mean, they talk about it. The students mm-hmm. are talking about it. This mm-hmm. is, I mean, they are really, really interested. They're really interested in problems of language. They're really interested in sort of very sophisticated examination of the facts and how far can we go in being creative before we begin to perhaps blur the lines and actually work against all that we're hoping to achieve. But I think both matter right now, that a very creative mind and a very artistic approach, and at the same time a reverence for the facts and the truth and what is real, and that in that process we might actually be able to have breakthrough. Creativity allows us to push through what we've always known and find what we did not know before. And that's what we need right now. We need new options, new solutions, new opportunities.
To learn more about Inara's work, see our show page found at kboo.fm and search for Politics of Living, Episode 11. We have a new contributor this month, Lynn Fitch. Lynn's a storyteller with Portland Story Theater, and this month she shares a story about learning life lessons from one of her own kids. It's titled, My Daughter, My Teacher.
Every morning it's something that enrages me, disgusts me, or brings fear into my heart. I can count on Trump and his administration for that, but not much else. Having endured Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan, and both Bush presidencies, I thought I had heard and seen almost everything, but I was mistaken. In less than a year, I have been ashamed, appalled, and filled with a sense of dread and hopelessness unlike anything I've experienced before. I don't know what to do, and I'm becoming more and more fearful about the future. Not just my own future, but I fear for so many others in a world I barely recognize anymore. I think about my children and my grandchildren, and I wonder what my daughter thinks about all of it. It seems simple enough. Just pick up the phone and give her a call. But you see, I can't. My daughter is a very conservative Republican who voted for Trump, and I'm a very liberal Democrat. Many years ago, we agreed to disagree and vowed never to discuss politics. It's an aspect of our relationship that saddens me, even though it does keep the peace and the lines of communication open. I also acknowledge that it is my intolerance and argumentative nature that led to the pact between us. I was raised in a household of stalwart Kennedy Democrats, Teamsters, Irish Catholics, who supported Lyndon Johnson's Great Society. My grandparents were FDR Democrats, part of the New Deal. Lively political discussions were common at our family dinners, with someone always playing the devil's advocate to keep the conversation going. As a teenager, the war in Vietnam was a heated topic that filled many dinner hours. I was against the war and had participated in marches in Seattle. I started a chapter of the Students for a Democratic Society at my high school, and I organized one of the first anti-war peace rallies in a public school in Washington State. I was politically idealistic and became a door-to-door campaigner for Robert Kennedy in his bid for the Democratic nomination in 1968. In school, I took speech and public speaking classes and joined debate. I became very skilled at developing strong, persuasive arguments, and it became a passion for me. I was ruthless in my approach, and my opponents rarely won. As I went through life, I only honed this skill, and I always took advantage of any opportunity to present my views and feelings about political topics. I leaned left and embraced socialist thought. I had little tolerance for views that did not match mine. I wanted to make things better for people and the world, and I became obsessed with defeating those whose ideas and opinions were different than mine. In hindsight, I can see how arrogant I was, and abusive and belittling to those who dared to oppose my way of thinking. But this was what I knew, my training, my upbringing. As I went through life and studied different spiritual philosophies, I began to question my warrior stance, always ready for battle, and believing that subduing my opponent was the only path to victory. Now I understood that pushing against only created a stronger push back. I tried to respond in love and not fear and anger. I believe that there is room for all kinds of viewpoints, and our job is to find commonalities and from there work together to change the world. But this Trump time has me feeling lost and powerless. My buttons are pushed and I explode all over social media. I don't understand their way of thinking. I don't know how to bridge the divide. And now I struggle with not knowing how to even be an activist. How do you fight for peace, love, and understanding? I always thought my children would think and believe like I did. Of course they would. How I believed was right, and I taught them my morals and values. I did all the right things. My daughter is amazing. From the day she was born, I knew she would make me proud and make a mark on the world. She had a liberal upbringing, was sent to attend a Grateful Dead concert in high school, won poetry slams, wanted to be a writer, and attended a trendy K-12 school. I should have seen the handwriting on the wall when, as a senior, she told me that she would have preferred to attend a more conservative school with a military structure and more discipline. She grew up, married, and started a family, and I continued the odyssey of my life. I suspected that our politics were not jiving when I would visit every few years, and awkward silences would happen, or my comments about George W. fell flat. But when we had the argument about abortion, I knew we'd crossed the great divide. One night, I was talking about the assault on women's rights, and she responded with a strong right-to-life statement. I, of course, launched into a counter-rebuttal. It was one of the most awkward moments in my life. We both just stopped talking and agreed that we disagreed on the subject and vowed not to bring it up again. Throughout the years, I held my tongue. I know I gloated when Barack won. And for 8 years, I basked in liberal agenda wonderfulness. I was happy, but I know that for her, the agenda was opposite of where her beliefs were. And then Trump ran for president. Early in the campaign, my daughter posted a mother and daughter manifesto on social media. She explained that she was a conservative Republican and her mom a liberal Democrat. And while we disagreed politically, she thanked me for raising her to be strong and believe as she did. She said that I raised her to be a free-thinking person who could determine her own path, have her own ideas and beliefs, and that no matter what, I would love and support her. My daughter and I, we talk every week. She calls for advice and to update me on the lives of my grandsons. I call for advice and lament about growing old. I love her deeply. Being politically apart has not diminished our love or connection. I've come to realize that my daughter is actually one of my most important teachers, a guide, if you will, helping me navigate this difficult and painful political time that has divided our country, helping me gain the tools to react in love and not fear to the world around me. I've always thought that I did something wrong, to have raised a daughter so politically different from myself. But you know, I did something right. My daughter is an honest, forthright, free-thinking human being. She stands behind her convictions. She's courageous, thoughtful, and kind. And she makes a point to inspire others to be the best they can be. I could not ask for any more. We may not agree on the politics of life, but we do find common ground when we focus on what truly matters: love, family, and friends. My Republican daughter has taught me to open my heart and be less judgmental and more accepting, more willing to listen and understand. Teach your parents well. She reminds me that diversity is really our strength, no matter how uncomfortable it gets and might feel. My younger warrior self would never have admitted this, but now I can see the wisdom in agreeing to disagree, focusing on what we hold in common, and keeping politics out of our conversations. Oh, I still have my socialist ideals, and I post rants daily against Trump policies. But thanks to her, I have love guiding my way.
That was Lynn Fitch. To learn more about her stories as well as Portland Story Theater, visit our show page at www.kbu.fm and search for Politics of Living, Episode 11. Darka Dusty returns with thoughts about what feels like never-ending tragedies due to gun violence. Darka reflects on some of the horrendous events and offers a call to action to demand for gun control. And one song helped her process the pain of bearing witness to one of those tragedies.
Why is having guns more important than saving lives to so many politicians? What can we do as regular citizens about this issue? It feels like it's only a matter of time. Fifty-eight killed in Las Vegas. 49 killed in Orlando. 27 killed in Sandy Hook Elementary School. The list goes on and on. But that Sandy Hook shooting, that really did me in. It was December 2012, just 11 days before Christmas, and 20 little children lost their lives. I was frozen. I could barely think. How could we let these children down? What is it about our country that lets this happen? So, this is a new year, and I want to see us elect some new officials in Washington who are ready to take on this incredibly difficult subject. How do we do it? We're going to have to elect the right people and make sure they answer these questions for us. On that day, December 14th, 2012, I was barely able to function, and all I could do was cry. Then suddenly, I heard a song, and it was by Dusty Springfield, the late, great Dusty Springfield. And I thought it was so melancholy, so beautiful, so poignant. And it came down like one of those Facebook pages, you know, and I just absolutely knew that I had to record this song. So I did that Carrie Fisher thing where you take your broken heart and you put it into art. And so my partner and I, Miri and I, we decided to record this song. We spent the next 24 hours recording it. I'd like to play it for you. It's written by Tom Springfield and Pepe Borza. That's what we did on that day. We recorded this song, and I dedicate it to all the little children that lost their lives. So as you hear it, we're still in the 12 days of Christmas as you hear this song. I want you to think about this. I want you to think about calling your representative, your senator, and I want you to tell them that gun control is important to you, however you want to put it. You know, whatever it means to you, just make it your business to be involved in this issue. That's my hope, that in 2018, we could make enough changes in Washington to do something about this terrible problem. So, here we go. It's called O Holy Child. And I dedicate it to all the children who lost their lives on December 14th, 2012.
And now our very own Vicky Mazzone shares a conversation she had with the creator of a website called March Every Day. The contributors that manage the site are a small group of friends here in Portland who are committed to turning love and anger into positive action by making a difference through e-commerce.
Hi, this is Vicky Mazzone with The Politics of Living, and my guest today is Lois McKenzie, who is the owner / creator of the March Everyday website. Hi, Lois.
Hi, Vicki.
Lois and her colleagues are, in the words of the website, committed to turning love and anger into action, and they believe in an America that welcomes, respects, and lifts up all people. So, Lois, when did you actually launch the website?
Well, the website actually wasn't launched till late this fall, but it was conceived right after the Women's March. And so in Portland, we marched with friends and neighbors, and a bunch of us were just really empowered by what we saw in the streets of Portland. It was peaceful, you know, it was powerful. It was pretty incredible.
And you were out in the rain.
Yes,
we were all out in the rain.
Weren't we? Perfect Northwest day. You really had to brave that.
Who are the other women, or who are the other colleagues on your website? Who all works with it?
Well, so it's mostly myself, but a lot of the slogans that you see on the website were all, you know, a part of. I kind of reached out to my group of friends and neighbors who we marched with and asked them. Some of our friends actually went to D.C., so and some are in Canada who also marched, and they came back and gave me, you know, a list. I asked people to bring in their favorite signs that they saw, really. And some were negative, some were funny. And what I tried to do was really select sort of the more hopeful and peaceful and loving, you know, unity-driven messages. And then in our neighborhood, I have some people who are very creative. So there's a graphic designer and also a writer. I had a neighbor who helped me with the merch assortment. And so we kind of came together and did a lot of talking, and then I kind of pulled everything together for the website.
And it takes a while to get all that launched, doesn't it?
It does. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of details. I had no idea.
On the merch side, you sell basically, what, T-shirts and tote bags and onesies, I think?
Yes, currently, yes.
Okay, and did you decide to do hats or no?
Well, I haven't yet, but I think there has been some requests for hats, as well as different like long sleeves, tank tops, T-shirts with V-necks. So, and a sweatshirt. My son wanted a sweatshirt, so we'll be definitely branching out. I just need to kind of get the site working without the kinks, and then we'll add more to the assortment.
So you had never launched a website before. You'd never done e-commerce?
Never, no. And so this was actually also a test for myself. As my kids start to leave, they're both in high school right now. My husband and I want to slow down a little bit, do a little bit more traveling, do, you know, some outreach out globally as well. And so we were trying to think of a way to live a little bit more, not as in isolation, but a little bit more globally. So I thought an online business would be a great way to try and do that. And so this was a test to see how things could work out. You know, I'm trained as an architect, and so I've never really done websites. A friend of mine, to put my portfolio together, recommended that I use Squarespace. And so I was able to put together a portfolio using their template, which they do make it very easy. And another friend that I met also said that you could do an e-commerce store with Shopify. So Shopify, to me, is almost like what Squarespace does, but actually has a huge e-commerce component to it. So I, you know, took me a couple months to kind of go through the tutorials and put it together. But, you know, it's possible to get an e-commerce store launched now.
As someone who was a regular working citizen, and you became a citizen, which I found fascinating. You're originally from Canada, yes?
Yes.
And you became a citizen, what, a couple years ago?
Yes, actually, the year that the election happened, a couple months before.
And that was your first election?
It was our first election. And we were very excited to vote in it.
You have been here for a while, so that you know that elections usually aren't as dramatic, shall we say.
Yes, we were actually reminiscing in our neighbor's house the other day over a Christmas party, because we all collect together at her house to watch, you know, a couple of elections together. And this one, I remember us all coming in so excited, you know, especially the women and the daughters, you know, looking forward to seeing our first women president. And I remember maybe 2 hours into the night, a really good friend of ours, she was completely silent, and it was everybody knew that it was not good. It wasn't going to be good.
So you became a citizen, and welcome to the USA, by the way. and you decided as a a regular everyday citizen to do this part, to do this as your part.
Yes.
So tell me about maybe the top two favorite slogans right now on the website that you can get on a t-shirt or a tote bag or.
Yeah. So one I'm wearing right now actually is Love is Love. And I really like that one. The other tote bag that I've been carrying around with me for a while is Build Bridges, Not Walls. As I look through on what people are purchasing, there's a lot of people that really like the science period one. And that was actually a good friend of mine that wanted to do a t-shirt like that. So I said I'd put that on the site for him. And he's ordered a bunch. What are some other ones? The Dignity, Respect, and Justice for All is another very popular one.
So how has the site been doing since its launch? It sounds like you guys are doing pretty good.
It's you know, slower. I think sometimes when you launch something after spending so much time, you have all these high hopes, and it is slower than I thought. And I had just actually attended a social media class, and she was mentioning that, you know, 50% of these e-commerce sites, they believe that, you know, they'll have a lot of traffic as soon as you get it online, but you know, at 50% of the owner's times are usually spent on social media, kind of promoting and marketing. And so that's definitely not my forte, but it's been fun to learn a lot about it and, you know, tried new things and actually get the family involved. My son's one of them really loves to take photographs, and so he's been giving me some styling advice and doing some photos for me.
And I should mention that for every item purchased on the March Everyday website, which is marcheveryday.com, that 100% of the net profits go to three organizations, the ACLU, which is, of course, is the American Civil Liberties Union, Planned Parenthood, and the NDRC, the National Resources Defense Council, which works to safeguard the natural systems of the earth. You also work with Indivisible. So let's talk a little bit briefly about what Indivisible is about and how you got involved.
Yes. So after the Women's March, actually, I was really looking to see where I can make a little bit of difference. You know, I didn't have a lot of time. And so I was invited to this Indivisible group in our neighborhood. And I was hoping to go to meetings, but after meeting, I was not able to attend due to my kids', you know, schedules with sports and such. So I finally actually met a woman who is doing a lot of work with Indivisible, and we started talking about fundraising, and she said, you know, Indivisible is just, you know, grassroots organization that really has shoestring budgets, and so any dollars help. And so we talked about launching this website to help, and that was one thing that I thought would be fun, is to do a campaign-driven, you know, organization donation. So maybe every month or a couple months, we'll choose another local organization that wants some assistance. And so this, for November, December, the profits or the proceeds are going to the Indivisible Fund.
Also, when you go onto the site, it says sign up for the mailing list and you give a special edition March Every Day hoodie away every month. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yep.
So that's marcheveryday.com. There's still time, I guess, to get things for Christmas?
Just barely. I think that, you know, our printing house had said that the deadline was on Monday.
Okay. So. Well, actually, this is going to re-air in January, so it's going to be after. Well, if you're really late for Christmas, you can order something in January.
For the first anniversary of the Women's March.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so what are you guys going to do for that?
I have some thoughts in mind. I haven't quite figured it out yet, but there will be something special, definitely.
Great. So check on marcheveryday.com. And Lois McKenzie, thank you so much for joining me. I'm Vicki Mazzone for The Politics of Living.
For more information about March Every Day, visit www.kibu.fm and search for The Politics of Living and look for Episode 11. And now, the She-Ra Solution with Kristen Thiel. The segment is a monthly biography of women, past and present. Its title is inspired by Maria Theresa Hart's article, She-Ra and the Fight Against the Token Girl, published in The Atlantic. On today's segment, Kristen talks about two artists who made space for women where it hadn't before existed, one in lights and one in a medium very close to the She-Ra Solution's heart.
To imagine Betty Willis's childhood is to imagine vast space of twinkling light. She was born in Las Vegas in 1924, one of eight children of parents who arrived in southern Nevada by horse and buggy in 1905 and built the city's first two-story house. Then, the desert's night was nothing but stardust. And neon. Betty loved the neon signs that started dotting the horizon below the constellations. She pressed her face to the window of her family's Studebaker as they drove down what would become the Las Vegas Strip. Then, just a quiet road crisscrossed by more quiet roads, watching the ever-increasing neon. Even on a cold night, the strip would be hot with neon. Literally. You could hear the mechanical flashing devices pop. In 1942, she went to art school in Los Angeles and then took a job drawing ads for Fox West Coast Theaters. Though her career path would eventually wind back toward art, she next took a very Las Vegas-type job. No, not in a casino or on the stage. She took a job at a courthouse. Again, though, probably not in the role you might imagine. She helped people not to marry, but to divorce. There was a dress code for appearing in court, and if a divorcee-to-be arrived too scantily clothed, Betty was there to offer an appropriate dress from the shared closet. Next came a job as a legal secretary. And by night, she got back into art. In the 1940s, she started illustrating a newspaper ads for Vegas shows. These, of course, featured a lot of showgirls, and Betty's ability to draw the female form improved with each ad. So when she started designing neon motel signs, called spectaculars, in the early 1950s, she was ready for the motel called the Blue Angel. Her sign depicted neon bluebirds pulling back a curtain to reveal an angel. She told the New York Times in 2005, quote, "I got criticized for depicting a super well-endowed angel. I said, well, show me an angel and I'll draw her." Each sign began as a watercolor. She used not just a brush, but a sawed-off pencil. Dipped in paint, this tool left dots that were the perfect look of light bulbs. In 1952, she took a job with Western Neon and helped one of the salesmen there realize his vision of a city welcome sign. Her "Welcome to Fabulous Las Vegas, Nevada" sign is a glorious diamond of neon. The fabulous added because, Betty said, we thought the town was fabulous. Unfortunately, the typography used for that word never lived up to her standards. She never liked the final amateurish look of it. She told the New York Times, quote, "I sweat blood when I take a good hard look at it." In her sign, each letter of the word welcome is ringed with silver dollars. She explained the reasoning behind that design choice, quote, "The circles were expensive, so we put in a lot of them." In 1959, the sign was ready, and Western Neon sold it to the county for $4,000. It is now owned by a private company and rented to the county. Betty never copyrighted it because she thought young Las Vegas needed free publicity. Later, she said she wouldn't mind making some money off of it since everyone else could and was. In 2005, Richard Hooker, Las Vegas' senior cultural specialist, told the New York Times that, quote, "Classic neon artists like Betty are the design heroes of the city, giving the place an image in the public mind. Their signs are like music to the eyes." Betty died in 2015 at age 91. At the time of her death, she was retired, though she'd kept her hand in the art world by helping her one daughter with her silkscreen business. Betty raised that daughter on her own, having had two marriages end in divorce. Betty said she loved working with men, but she hated living with them. "Jerks," she said of her two husbands. The first one drank too much, but he was cute. As she spoke, her gaze resembled that of a, quote, "rattlesnake eyeing a prairie dog," the New York Times reporter said. I don't really know what that means, but I can imagine. Our second woman this month does not have as much of a life story as Betty, because she's only 25. But considering her few years, Noelle Stevenson is accomplishing a lot, including the project which brought her to my attention. She is showrunning a reboot of the She-Ra cartoon, due out on Netflix this very year. The press release promises all we could hope for, as in a, quote, "timely tale that celebrates female friendship and empowerment, led by a warrior princess tailor-made for today." All of us here at the She-Ra Solution are very excited. Beyond helming this reboot, Noelle has an impressive resume. In 2015, when she was only 23 years old, she was nominated for 3 Eisner Awards, which are considered the Oscars of the comics industry. She's known for work like Lumberjanes, about 3 best friends who get involved in supernatural mysteries at their summer camp. She thinks the series fills a, quote, very glaring hole in the print comics market. The success of the series may indicate that, indeed, the market was craving stories with a greater diversity of characters. Noelle herself did not imagine working in comic books because she didn't see herself in either the characters or the creators. It was thanks to innovations in internet comics that she saw a place for herself. She told the Los Angeles Times in 2015, quote, "It was not until webcomics that I saw stories about women and stories by women and things that were aimed specifically at female readership. It was just kind of this free-for-all that was achieving something amazing with creativity. That was where I got my start." Noelle attended the Maryland Institute College of Art and studied the work of children's book illustrators. Her comics often reflect that whimsical spirit. Her goals in the industry are anything but whimsical, however. As she told the LA Times, quote, "We can make this industry and this environment and comic book shops and comic book conventions and comic books themselves, we can make them a thing that is accessible to everybody so that nobody feels unwelcome and nobody feels like this isn't their place." If only Noelle's and Betty's careers had crossed paths. Seems like they would have been great co-hosts of a party. Maybe on the Las Vegas Strip, near the welcome sign, under the stars, doors wide open to all. I'm your host, Kristen Thiel, and I'll be back next month.
Well, that is all the time we have for this episode of The Politics of Living. Thanks to our contributors, Kristen Thiel, Anessa Anderson, Darka Dusty, Vicky Mazzone, and Lynn Fitch. Thanks to our guests, and thanks to our technical editor, Liam Delta, and webpage manager, Vicky Mazzone. We're going to close out the show with a track by local musician Terry Unnelin. It's called Thank You Note. Thanks so much for listening to The Politics of Living. I'm Denise Kowalczyk. Have a great day.
If I looked in your eyes, I would start to cry, 'cause I can't. Sending you a thank you note. said.